all stable, and the close quarters have made them pushy. You used to use your gift instead of your hands. Or have you lost it, being here so long? Kara sets her jaw and looks up at her pretty sister. I've never used my gift for something as frivolous as cleaning a stall. She opens the stall doors and leaves, resting the pitchfork against the wall before moving down the line. She places a measure of grain into the black horse's bucket and strokes his nose. Frivolous, Madrigal says. She sucks her cheek indignantly. No, I suppose you wouldn't. Frivolity is strictly my domain, is that it? I didn't say that. Of course you didn't. You never say what you mean. Kara clenches her jaw. She looks back at the black horse and smells the savory scent of his breath as he chews the grain. I haven't seen a horse this well-bred in a long time. And those saddle horses, did you borrow them from Addy Lane? They aren't bad at all. Madrigal puts her hands on her hips. She taps her foot. She has barely been at the cottage for a week, and already she has climbed on Kara's last nerve. What do you want, Madrigal? To look after my daughter. That isn't what I meant. I meant right now. Is there something you want to say? Her eyes drift down to Madrigal's belly. If it's that you're pregnant, I can see that already. Madrigal glances toward her waist. It is early yet, but on her slight frame it shows enough for Kara to know. Jules must be glad to be a big sister, Kara goes on. I'm so proud to see her grown up strong and happy. And Joseph, he looks so much like Matthew. For a moment I almost ran and jumped into his arms. Madrigal swallows. She murmurs something under her breath. Maddie, speak up! Don't call me Maddie, Madrigal snaps. But there is something that Madrigal wants to tell her, some unpleasant thing, from the way she stands there towing annoying patterns into the dirt. The baby, Madrigal says. It's Matthew's. Kara's fingers grip the stall door. Every horse in the barn stops eating and looks at her, even Willa's mean brown mule. Matthew. Her Matthew. But he is not her Matthew anymore. I just wanted to be the one to tell you, Madrigal says, her voice uncertain. I didn't want Jules or Joseph to blurt it out. She steps closer, soft, hesitant steps in the dust and straw. Kara? What? Say something. What do you want me to say? That I've been waiting here like a fool, when I knew there was no hope in waiting? That things change out there, but nothing changes here? You don't need me to tell you those things. I'll leave here old and bent, like Willa. And you don't need my blessing if you want to live my life for me. That's not what I'm doing, Madrigal says, as Kara's brown hound starts to howl. Quiet. The howl means company, and company means you have to hide. The old man and his pony cart take their time coming down the path to the black cottage. It is a good thing, for it gives Arsinoe plenty of time to get comfortable in her hiding spot, seated beneath a window. Peering out, she sees Jules and Joseph dart into the stables. Who knows where Madrigal is? When old Worcester reaches the house, Willa helps him to unload his sacks of grain and jugs of wine, along with three or four wrapped parcels. They talk for what feels like an eternity before he finally turns his cart back down the path. Much of what they discussed seems to be about a letter he gave to her. She stands in the middle of the supplies and reads it again and again until Arsinoe loses her patience. She gets to her feet and throws up the sash. Willa? What is that? Willa walks the letter back into the cottage. The others emerge from the stable like squirrels from their burrows. Arsinoe takes the letter and reads it. What is it? Asks Jules as she comes inside. It's an announcement, Arsinoe says. Mirabella is challenging Katarine to a duel. Is that wise? Madrigal asks. A hunt is a risk, but a duel is riskier still. A show of frontal assaults? Both could die. The goddess will not allow both to die, says Willa. How do you know? Joseph asks. Because in all our long history, she has never allowed all of her queens to die. And I should know. Half of our library here is volumes of queen history. But all of her queens wouldn't be dead, Jules says. If both Mirabella and Catherine die in the duel, Arsinoe will still be alive. Every eye turns to her, and Arsinoe steps back. Maybe that is the plan, Jules says. The goddess's plan. But Willa waves her hand. No, Mirabella will be the queen crowned. Queen Camille knew it. The entire island has known it until recently. Arsinoe has been granted her life, a fugitive life in secret. Nothing more. You haven't seen how many times she's saved her, Joseph says, and brought her back. Just to live life as a fugitive? I don't believe it. Arsinoe scoffs. They have all gone mad, looking at her like that, eyes big as dinner plates and twice as sparkly. She stares past them at a large woven tapestry hanging on the wall. It depicts the hunt of the stags, the ritual performed by suitors during the Beltane of a crowning year. The tapestry shows young men with bared teeth and shining knives. One lies disemboweled in the foreground, and the stag they hunted has fallen onto its knees. There is so much blood. It is a wonder the weaver did not run out of red thread. And that could be Billy, bleeding to death on the sacred ground of Innisfool. All these brutal traditions, Arsinoe says quietly. Arsinoe? Madrigal asks. For a long time, Arsinoe dreamed of a chance like this one. To run away, to disappear. But always the goddess moved her about like a game piece, placing her where she wanted her. She even gave her jewels, legion-cursed jewels, who Luke had always said was put nearby for a reason. But what was that reason? To win her freedom? Or to win the crown? Either way, Arsinoe is tired of wondering. She swallows hard and feels her scars, every one of them, from her cheek to her ribs. From now on, she will do what she wants. We have to go to Indrid Down, she says. Yes, Jules says and claps her hand. Mirabella and Catherine will make their last stand, and when they fall, you will be there, waiting. No, Jules. Willa is right. Mirabella is the chosen queen, and I think I was spared so I could help her. She grasps Jules by the shoulders, crumpling the duel challenge in her fist. I'm going to the capital, and I'm going to help Mirabella put down that poisoner queen. The Queen's Duel. Rolanth. Mirabella's coaches are outfitted with silver fastenings and black plumes. The blue elemental insignia flies on flags beside the queen's black ones, and there are white coaches too, white coaches pulled by white horses and filled with priestesses so that all of Indrid Down will know that the temple stands with her. Are you sure you would not rather go by sea? Sarah asks, as they pack the last of Mirabella's things into trunks. It would be safer. She would parade into my city, Mirabella says. So I will parade into hers. Sarah holds up a gown. This? For the ball? Mirabella barely glances at it. It is some shiny satin thing with a fitted bodice and wide straps. That is fine. She turns about the room. Her room at Westwood House, since she was taken from the Black Cottage. It is not bare. She has not overpacked. But it still feels emptied, like if she speaks too loud her voice will echo. And for the jewels? Anything but black pearls, she says. I have heard that Katarine favors black pearls, and I do not want us to look alike.
You could never look alike, says Billy.
Mirabella and Sarah turn. Billy stands just inside the door. Sarah cocks an eyebrow at his crimson shirt. He should not wear it when they go to the capital, still mourning for a fallen queen, when he has declared for Mirabella. But no one will ask him to take it off, and the crimson will win them more favor from the naturalists. Sarah curtsies and leaves to give them privacy.
How much longer will the mourning last? Billy asks.
Not long, Mirabella replies. Soon the candles and the crimson will be gone. The prayers said for Arsinoe at altars will cease. Vanquished queens are not spoken of past the ascension year. There is no hall in the Volroy that houses their portraits. No one even remembers their names.
Are you ready? She asks.
Do you have attire for the ball?
I do.
Though I can't believe we're going to dance and feast with them the night before you kill her.
The ball is nothing more than Katarine's way of regaining control. I set the duel, so she sets the ball. It is all quite transparent, and it will not work.
Billy holds up a long rectangular box.
I brought something for you.
He opens it and takes out a choker of black gems, cut into faceted ovals and set in silver. They sparkle as he turns them in the light, and she wonders how long ago he bought them, and if they were meant for someone else. But she will not ruin the moment by asking.
Here,
he says, and Mirabella holds up her hair to let him place them around her neck.
They are beautiful.
Far more beautiful than anything the poisoner has, he says. They can dress that little witch up any way they like, but she'll still be a monster.
Do not say that word, Mirabella cautions. We do not say witch here.
No matter what we feel about Katarine, you must be careful when we are in the capital.
I would have you be a popular king consort among the people.
Billy grits his teeth.
Of course. It's just what she did.
I know.
I hate her. Don't you? She took her from me. From us.
Billy's hand lingers on her shoulder, from fastening the choker, and Mirabella lays hers atop it.
I met Katarine before Beltane, he says. My father wanted me introduced to all of you, before the other suitors.
You never came to me.
I chose Arsinoe before I could.
But it's the strangest thing. When I met Katarine, she seemed so sweet, harmless even. I actually pitied her. The girl I met was nothing like the one in Wolf Spring. But I suppose I only saw what she wanted me to see.
I suppose, says Mirabella. Billy, before we depart, I would have you pen a letter to precede us into the capital.
A letter? Saying what?
Saying that you will be my king consort and will not pay court to Katarine. Phrase it as meanly as you like. But I would have one more blow to her ego before she sees me at the ball.
Indrid Down. Natalia and Genevieve walk briskly through the bustling streets of the capital after overseeing the improvements being made to the arena. Repairs to the stands and extra risers built, a fresh coat of paint on the gallery rail, and all the vast competition ground tilled through and made soft. The tufts of long, hard grass and field stones removed by hand. It has been a long time since the arena was used for anything but fairs and carnivals. A long time since the island has seen a duel, or even since it had a war queen who enjoyed watching battle sport. The hotels will run out of rooms, Genevieve grumbles. There will be tents set up along the roadsides. People will sleep on the streets.
Only for a few days. And while they are here, they will spend their money. Up and down the main thoroughfare on High Street, shop windows are filled with fresh displays of goods. Carts, laden with golden smoked ducks and baskets of fruit, travel down back alleys to be unloaded into storerooms. It is a chance for non-poisoner merchants to show their best, and they have been down at the Barden Harbor docks since before dawn, fighting with the poisoner shops over the choice sea catch,
before it is laced with henbane and nightshade. They will spend money and make money, says Genevieve. The elemental merchants will set up stalls to sell their paintings and weavings and glass trinkets. Natalia watches her sister pout. After the duel is over, Genevieve is sure to be wearing an elemental jewel or two and parading about in a new silk scarf. Everyone knows that the finest ones come from Roland. May we stop for a bite to eat? Genevieve asks, craning her neck toward her favorite cheese shop. We will take tea at the Highburn, since we must go there anyway to finalize the ball. Natalia takes a high step over a gutter and tugs on Genevieve's sleeve to hurry her along. Smile. We should not be seen with troubled frowns on our faces. But we are troubled, Genevieve says, as she brightens her expression. The duel is a disaster. They will be face to face, trapped there together until one lies dead. It will be just as if the ascension were to end with them locked in the East Tower. It is just what we have been trying to avoid. Well, perhaps we did not need to. Cat is not the weak queen she once was. I do not know what has changed, but it is like she has woken up. You do know what has changed, even if you will not tell me. You must know what happened when she went missing after Beltane. You must. I do not. She is so strange now. Genevieve's eyes narrow. With those knives she throws and that mad laugh that comes out of her sometimes. Eating so much poison and practically enjoying the sickness that follows. Do not speak of her like that. Cat is not strange. She is not your daughter either. She is a queen. So stop calling her Cat. Natalia stops mid-stride and clenches her fists. Were they not in the middle of a busy public street, she would strike her sister across the face. Genevieve clears her throat and lowers her eyes. Forgive me. It is the strain of the duel. Natalia resumes walking. They are not far now from the Highburn. She can see its flags rising above the other buildings ahead. Do not worry so much, Genevieve. Natalia says quietly. Catherine was clever enough to give us the opportunity of a ball. Tomorrow night, Mirabella will be there amid food and crowds, and by the time it is over, she will be no threat in the duel. You intend to poison her? Genevieve asks, hurrying to keep pace. Not to death, just to weaken, so that Catherine will have an easy time of it in the arena. She will be able to slaughter her in front of the entire island at her leisure. How will you manage that? Your sleight of hand is good, but they will not allow us near her. You will not be able to get close enough. I do not need to, Natalia says. Why do you think I have maintained the alliance with Chatworth all this time? Why do you think he has insinuated himself into the Westwoods' trust? She rolls her shoulders back. He will do it. We cannot trust a mainlander with this. And what if old Luca has turned him? Impossible. The temple is not rich enough. Mirabella thinks to charge into the capital like a thundercloud. But when I am through, she will not even be able to make it rain. The Highburn Hotel. The Highburn Hotel is a grand place, larger and more finely built than anything in Roland. The hotel's ceilings stretch high overhead, checkered in black and gold. The columns in the ballroom are gilded, and the chandelier is the biggest Mirabella has ever seen. In her rooms they find large beds stuffed with down, the coverlets embroidered with gold and red thread. What a pleasant place to stay in, Mirabella muses. Were I not here to kill or die? Mirabella takes a seat beside her window and looks out across the rooftops. Indra Down is very pretty, and the strong smells of the crowded city do not rise that high, so the breeze is fresh and warm. The Highburn is directly across from the West Tower of the Volroy, separated only by a wide street and a long, hedge-lined courtyard of rosebushes and lilacs. Closer to the fortress, she can just make out the shape of a cage, mostly obscured by topiary shrubs. Inside is a brown, motionless hill of fur. Arsinoe's bear. It survived after all, and is now the prisoner of their poisoner sister. Well, that will end too, after Katarine is dead. Though Mirabella does not quite know what she will do with the big familiar. Someone knocks at the door that separates her room from the sitting room, and she tears her eyes away.
Mirabella, come out now and keep your strength up, Billy says, his voice muffled through the wood. I've brought a platter of food that required practically no cooking.
Practically no cooking. It really is a wonder that he has gotten no better at it. No better at all. Mirabella joins him in the sitting room, where he has cut a loaf of bread and spread it with butter. There are also some jarred apples and a wedge of blue-veined cheese.
I miss your apron, she says, and he laughs.
They eat for a few moments in silence. It is quiet on the top floor, but downstairs must be loud with people preparing for the ball tomorrow night. Sarah, Bree, and Elizabeth are there, and Luca, with her gaggle of priestesses, intent on observing every move the Aarons make.
Have you seen the bear? Mirabella asks quietly.
His name is Braddock, Billy replies, his voice grave. And I have. I walked through the courtyard and snuck him some sugared walnuts from a street vendor.
No one tried to stop you?
They don't even have a fence around the cage. I suppose they don't think anyone would be stupid enough to stick their arms between the bars. Maybe even I shouldn't have.
Do not be silly. He is still her familiar, even if she is gone. He remembers those she loved.
Billy's bite of bread stalls between his plate and his mouth.
Will we let him go, after it's over? He asks. Back to the woods at Innisfool, where she found him.
Is that what she would want?
I don't know.
I think so.
Or maybe she would want Jules to have him.
Billy runs his hand roughly across his face. Mirabella takes a deep breath and looks around the room. It is calm and elegant, the windows closed against the noisy streets and armed priestesses set in pairs in the hall.
It will all be over soon, she says.
One sleepless night, then the ball, and then the duel.
And then you are queen, says Billy.
Mirabella quiets. Up to now, it has all been haste and resolve, quickly mobilizing the priestesses and the Westwoods, and thinking of ways to antagonize Katarine. But now she is here, with only hours to fill before their fate, and her certainty is beginning to fade. What was it Luca said about knowing the goddess's will? Clear one moment, and gone the next.
Mirabella, are you all right?
Not quite, she says.
What?
After the duel, I will be the presumptive queen. I will not be crowned officially until Beltane in the spring, so you will have fall and a long winter to wait before you are a king.
Billy wipes at the corners of his mouth with a napkin. He would rather wait longer. Before she can be crowned, he may come to resent this bargain they struck.
We are friends, are we not, Billy? And friendship in marriage is a strong foundation. Hesitantly, he slides his hand across the table and turns it palm up. Equally hesitant, she places her hand atop it. She feels no spark, no quickening of her pulse. Looking into his eyes is not like looking into Joseph's. She squeezes his hand.
But I am not her, she says, and sighs. I am not Arsinoe. And if, come Beltane, you do not wish to take part in the hunt of the stags and do not wish to become king... He shakes her hand lightly.
Don't think of this now. There's plenty of time. Only, I didn't think there would still be a hunt, since we've declared for each other.
It will only be a formality. Nicholas Martell may still take part, and he may try to kill you and take the crown, but we will have priestesses on the hunt to guard you.
Well, that's good, then,
he says sarcastically. He turns toward the windows.
What is that sound?
Sounds like chanting.
They go to the window and look down.
A crowd is gathered, big enough to block the street between the Highburn and the Volroy, which is causing some shouting on both sides as carts try to make their way past.
Those in the center stare up at her floor, cursing her, telling her to go back to Roland.
Mira, Billy says, you're smiling.
Am I? She gazes down and chuckles.
To hear Luca tell it, the whole island is sick of poisoners and I am the savior they wait for.
What a tale.
It is true, to some, to many.
She draws on her gift.
Below, dark shadows form on the upturned faces of the crowd as her thunderclouds gather over the hotel.
The people stop shouting.
She cracks lightning through the air, and they duck and hold on to each other.
What are you doing? Billy asks.
Nothing, she replies. Only making sure that they know that the Elemental Queen is here.
Greavesdrake Manor. Peter glares out the window at Nicholas practicing his archery, this time from horseback. Every time Nicholas gallops past, Catherine can see Peter wishing for him to fall. And every time Nicholas shoots, she flinches, expecting the bolt to break through the window and pierce Peter's chest.
There is something off about him, Catherine, Peter says, and not just for a mainlander.
Peter, come away from the window.
You should get rid of him. He will never be your king consort anyway. You know Natalia intends to choose the Chatworth boy.
Catherine makes a face. Chatworth is with Mirabella now. Before that, he was with Arsinoe.
I do not know what she can be thinking, Catherine says. What will that look like, to accept my sister's cast-offs?
And besides, I do not like him.
But you like Nicholas?
And when Catherine does not answer,
that is ridiculous. You cannot like Nicholas.
At first it was good fun to make Peter jealous, to make him suffer. He had it coming and worse after all. But the joke is not a joke anymore. He seethes at Nicholas, and Nicholas's cool response unnerves her. The moment Nicholas gets a whiff of power, he will find a way to hurt Peter. Whether to humiliate him or kill him, she is not sure, but she senses he is capable of either. They are in the billiards room, but neither is focused enough to play. She shoots and listens to the balls clack together, not watching where they go. Instead, she watches Peter pout. Even pouting, he is handsome.
I do not like the ideas he puts into your head. He encourages you to be reckless.
Peter breaks away from the window and comes to roll the cue ball across the table, angrily stuffing it into a pocket.
Perhaps it is you I should send away, she whispers.
But he only scoffs and crosses his arms as if she cannot mean it.
Nicholas is a better match for me now, in many ways. Even better than you.
His eyes raise to hers.
Cat, that is not true.
Our goals are more aligned. We have similar minds. And if I decide to defy Natalia, he will make a strong king consort. She inclines her head and tries to be kind.
It is not fair, this game that I have made you play, thinking we could be together again, that there was hope for us.
Once, she thought that she would keep Peter as her lover, no matter which suitor she married. But that is a dream from a long time ago, and dreamed by a different Catherine.
Peter, I want you to go.
Go?
He asks.
Go where?
I do not care. Away from here, back to the country? But you must go, and go now.
His bright blue eyes swim with something like regret. Will he weep?
If he weeps, she will not have the heart to send him off. She will take him in her arms instead.
Why are you saying this?
When she does not respond, he shakes his head adamantly. I cannot go now. You are to fight a duel in 2 days. You do not know what you are saying. This ascension, it has made you volatile. When you return to your senses, you will thank me for staying. He talks to her as if she is a child, and whispers break into her mind. Angry, sweet whispers, and her fingers move to her ankle, to the poisoned blade she always keeps there. She slides it from its sheath, almost without realizing what she is doing. Peter has turned his back on her. A mistake. But he turns around at the last instant, and the knife slices through the air instead of his skin.
Katarine!
I said go. So you go, she says.
Cat, stop!
She strikes again and catches his sleeve. The dark gray fabric begins to stain red. He backpedals around the billiard table and into the bar, knocking over a tray and a decanter of Natalia's favorite tainted brandy.
It is for your own good, she says miserably. There is danger for you here.
I do not care. I will not leave you, Kat. And you still love me, I know that you do.
Katarine stops short. Whatever is left in me that can love, she says, loves you. Before he can speak, she raises the knife and carves into her own face, along the hairline and her ear, as though cutting off a mask. Her blood runs bright red down her neck and into her bodice.
Katarine, he whispers.
Oh, my Katarine.
Peter Reynard, she says in a gravelly voice. We have not been your Katarine since you threw me down the Breccia domain.
Peter stumbles out of Greavesdrake in a daze. Katarine told him to go, but he did not gather any of his belongings. Instead, he rushes to the stable and saddles the best horse he can find. His hands tremble as he tightens the cinch. All he can see is the image of her cutting into herself.
It is not her fault.
He leads the horse quickly out of its stall and mounts.
It is my fault, and I will find a way to make it right.
Peter puts his heel to the horse and gallops down the drive, hurrying for the road that curves north around the capital and on to Prynne. He will ride all day and into the night, then rest and change horses in the morning. He will ride all the way to Innisfool Valley, back to the cold, dark heart of the island, the Breccia Domain.
The Road to Indrid Down. Jules, Arsinoe says, you've been staring at that map for hours. They are traveling through the quiet roads in the shadow of the mountain, all on horseback, except for Arsinoe, who had to borrow Willa's ill-tempered brown mule. It is sticky hot, even riding in the shade, but Jules and Kara both insist that everyone keep their cloak hoods up in case anyone passes. Jules, it's a good thing you're a naturalist, else your horse would have run face-first into a tree with all the attention you're paying. Jules responds with a grunt, but keeps on studying the map of the capital.
Let her be, Arsinoe, Joseph says, riding up beside her. If she studies now, by the time we reach Indrid Down, she'll be able to pass through the city like water in a stream, and we won't have to study as much.
You should still study it, Jules mutters.
Give it here, then, he says and holds his hand out. But she will not relinquish the map. That's what I thought.
Is that the war gift? Arsinoe asks him quietly. The strategy? The preparation?
Joseph shrugs. And in the saddle, Jules frowns. No one knows. There is so much about the war gift that none of them understands.
Arsinoe shoves her hood down and tosses her short hair. I miss the breeze off the cove, she says.
Put your hood back up,
says Kara, riding behind on her stout chestnut mountain mare.
Let her keep it down, Madrigal objects.
She takes down her own and leans her head back to catch the wind.
We haven't seen anyone since we left the cottage. These roads are practically deserted. You said so yourself.
It doesn't mean we shouldn't be cautious.
You never should have come anyway. You'll get us into trouble if we're caught with you away from the Black Cottage.
Madrigal, says Kara mildly. We are traveling with a presumed dead queen and a legion-cursed fugitive. If we're caught, my being away from the cottage will be the least of our offenses.
Madrigal scowls. She twists in the saddle back toward Jules.
How much farther until we reach Indrid Down?
Tomorrow? Afternoon, maybe. Or just before nightfall.
Good, Arsinoe says. I want to go and see Braddock.
Jules lowers the map. The notice of the duel was not the only news that Worcester brought with him. He also told tales of Catarine's victorious return to the capital and the parade of the vanquished naturalist's bear familiar.
I know that you do, Jules says, but we can't risk it. When everyone is distracted by the duel, Kara and Madrigal will sneak in and free him. Then you can see him afterward.
But I left him for dead, says Arsinoe. I need to explain to him why I just left him there, for her to put in a cage.
From the ground, Camden stands and puts her paws up onto Arsinoe's knee, before jumping into the saddle to provide heavy cougar comfort.
Thanks, Cam, Arsinoe says around the cat's licks. But you're angering the mule.
Camden yawns, unbothered by the mule's grunting and ineffectual bucks, occasionally whapping the mule in the face with her tail.
Camden, be nice to that mule, Jules says, and then looks at Arsinoe.
Braddock is a good bear. He'll forgive you.
Arsinoe quiets and lets Jules concentrate on the map. It is she who will have the most to do when they arrive in the capital. It will be up to her to use her war gift to sabotage Catarine's poisoned weapons and guide them safely off course.
It makes Arsinoe's stomach tighten just to think of it.
Joseph sees the look on her face. He rides close and nudges her with his knee.
It'll be fine, he says.
Barden Harbor. A shining mainland boat is docked in a private errand slip on the northern shore of Barden Harbor. Inside, Natalia lies in William Chatworth's arms, the soft rocking of the water threatening to lull her to sleep.
I'm surprised, he says and puffs cigar smoke. I didn't think you would be able to sneak away for so long, not with the ball tonight.
For so long? Natalia chuckles, watching the smoke swirl patterns in the air.
It was not really so long,
but it was pleasant. They have not been together for months, and she is surprised to find she has missed it. Missed him, in a way.
Chatworth tugs his arm from beneath her head and stubs out his cigar.
Do you have it, then? He asks.
Of course I do. It is the main reason I came.
She hands him a small bottle, and he holds it gingerly between two fingers.
Stop being afraid of it, she says. You could drink it all and it would not kill you. Nor will it hurt if it gets on your hands.
She sits up in the small bed and reaches for her clothes, a servant's uniform that she changed into on the carriage ride from Greavesdrake.
If it's so weak, he wonders, why bother?
Insurance?
I would take the wind out of that elemental.
My Catarine wants the chance to humiliate her, so she shall have it.
Natalia stands and fastens the last of her buttons. Chatworth remains on the bed, languorous and confident, perhaps overconfident, and it occurs to her that, aside from having bluster and money, he has never shown any particular skill.
If you are caught, she says and pauses. Do not get caught.
Don't worry. Everyone in that camp trusts my son. And Sarah Westwood has come to trust me.
Has she? Then she is an even bigger fool than I thought.
Don't be jealous, he says.
But he means the opposite. He is such a vain and beautiful man. She wonders whether that son of his will grow to be just as vain, just as arrogant. Whether he will be difficult to manage when he is Catarine's king consort.
Come back to bed.
There is no time.
But I like you so much in that outfit.
He tries to grab her, but she steps away and whips his arms with her cotton apron.
Just poison that elemental brat, will you, and stop playing about.
She turns and leaves amid his laughter, to sneak back onto the docks and return home unnoticed. The Queen's Ball. Jules spins out of the way as a servant with a tray of wine nearly crashes into her. He calls her an imbecile, and she grits her teeth and curtsies. She must keep her head bowed. Joseph's orders, as he said her two-colored eyes, made her far too easy to notice, even with Camden safely hidden away in a nearby stable.
"There's a bounty on your head," he said, "and the city is crawling with guards. You shouldn't go at all."
But Arsinoe could not rest easy without at least one set of eyes on Mirabella. So here Jules is. Jules lowers her chin and walks through the corridors bordering the kitchen nearest to the northern ballroom. Many guests are already inside, and more rustle through the doors every minute. Close to the entrance, there are too many searching glances gawking at the finery and hoping for a glimpse of the queens. But those will lessen once Mirabella and Catherine make their entrances and draw away all of the attention. Jules turns down a hall, the heels of her boots loud against the floor. The stone of the Highburn Hotel amplifies everything, and though the passageways are wide and well-aired by the opening and closing front doors, to Jules, they are suffocating. Nothing in the capital is open enough, and she misses the fields and docks of home. She turns and pretends to move a vase as another servant passes by. "Nothing will happen here anyway, with all these people and priestesses milling about," she mutters, before realizing Camden is not there to mutter too. She should have stayed with Joseph and Arsinoe, or gone with Aunt Kara and Madrigal to the dueling arena. She is about to do just that, when a black cloak catches her eye, passing the kitchens. "What's this now?" she whispers, before following it down the corridor. Mirabella and Billy wait on the staircase outside of the ballroom's eastern entrance, two still statues in the midst of chaos as attendants put finishing touches on Mirabella's makeup and straighten the fall of her gown and Billy's coattails. Mirabella's fingers rest in the crook of Billy's arm. On some other staircase, she does not doubt that Catherine's rest similarly in Nicholas Martel's. Billy looks over at her. His choker of black gems sparkles at her throat, and he smiles. Her future king consort. Her suitor now. For real. On the other side of the large wooden door, sounds of the ball grow quiet, and she hears Luca's muffled voice announce her entrance. "It is time," Sarah whispers over her shoulder. And the door opens.
"Are we supposed to smile and nod?" Billy asks. "How do we play to the crowd when more than half of them want you dead?"
Mirabella laughs. It breaks the spell of silence, and the guests begin to whisper among themselves. They murmur about her dress, about her jewels, about how lovely she and the suitor look together. Billy helps her up the steps to the Westwood table, and they stand behind their chairs to wait for Catherine. They do not have to wait long. When she appears, the guests muffle, poisoners and non-poisoners alike. Catherine's skirt flares out with her long strides, her hair in shining curls. She does not seem small anymore. She does not seem at all like the pale, pinned-tight girl she was atop the cliffs when Mirabella was first reunited with her at the disembarking. "The undead queen," they whisper. "But she has never seemed more alive." "She wants it more than I do," Mirabella says, watching Catherine's lips curl as she turns to whisper into Nicholas's ear.
"It doesn't matter," Billy replies stiffly. "She still won't get it."
Before Catherine and her suitor take their place amid the errands, dazzling in their snakes and scorpions, Catherine cocks her head at Mirabella and winks. Nicholas smiles at Billy and discreetly spits onto the floor. Billy's jaw tightens. You are right. It does not matter, Mirabella says, and squeezes his hand. Fine, he says as they sit. But if he takes part in the hunt of the stags this year, he'll find my boot in his back in the middle of the woods. She has no doubt that is true. Billy is so like Arsinoe was. What a fine match they would have made had she lived. Thinking of Arsinoe, she watches Katarine intently until the high burn is rattled by a great, cold gust of wind. Inside, the guests shudder and duck. Tomorrow, Bree says out of the side of her mouth. Save it for the duel. She stretches her long leg past Sarah's skirts to kick Mirabella beneath the table, and Mirabella tears her eyes away from her sister so the wind will quiet. Yes, tomorrow. The musicians begin to play. Servants circulate small bunches of dark purple grapes and cups of wine. There is excitement in the air. The people are joyous, celebrating, and if there is any undercurrent at all, it is of relief. One queen has been killed, and two stand ready to claim the crown. Things are as they should be. Bree pushes away from the long table and takes both Mirabella and Billy by the hands. Come, let us dance. They step onto the floor, and the crowd parts to make room, priestess guards gathering around the edge. Bree stays only a moment, smiling and twirling in circles, before she wanders away to find her own partner. She will not have much trouble. Bree is luminous as always. Her festival gown is easily the most beautiful, strapless and black, with silver beads sewn into the fabric. Billy turns Mirabella about, keeping close to the Westwood table. You are a very fine dancer, Mirabella says.
I ought to be. After 6 years of forced lessons, I can do most any dance you would require for any formal occasion.
You probably know dances that I have never heard of.
Possibly. But don't worry. I'm also a very fine teacher.
His eyes are warm, charming and wrinkled at the corners. For a moment, it seems as if Arsinoe's eyes are boring into her back, and Billy misses his step. What is wrong? She asks.
Nothing. He says quickly. Nothing, I only thought I saw. Never mind.
She tugs Billy close and squeezes him.
I think I can feel her too, she whispers.
They keep dancing, but on stiff legs. When he turns her toward the poisoner table, she glares at Katarine and hopes her little sister can feel the hatred from them both.
Look, Billy says when they turn back to the Westwoods. My father is here.
William Chatworth is leaning across her table, talking to Sarah. He is leaning so far that his sleeves are nearly dipping into their wine cups.
He didn't tell me he was going to be here.
Billy spins her faster.
He's probably angry that I didn't tell him about our betrothal.
He pulls her sharply around.
Ouch! Oh, I'm sorry, he says.
His eyes narrow at his father. Walking around the table now to take Mirabella's empty seat beside Sarah.
Nothing distracts me quite like he does. Did I hurt you?
No, you... She stops. For a moment she thinks she is imagining it. But there is Joseph, watching them from the crowd.
What are you? She whispers.
Joseph shakes his head. He steps back to disappear into the other guests. But Bree has seen him too, and grabs him and drags him into a dance, chattering furiously into his ear. Bree? Mirabella calls, and Bree presses her lips together in a very serious, un-Bree-like line. She dances Joseph closer.
He should not be here, Bree hisses, holding on to him with a grip like iron.
Why not? Billy asks. He's my foster brother, isn't he?
Billy? Joseph says. He glances around furtively. His dark hair is brushed back, and those storm blue eyes of his can take Mirabella to the ground with one look.
Jules is here somewhere.
Oh. Billy pulls Mirabella slightly away.
What is she doing here? When did she get back?
I can't explain now,
Joseph says, and I can't stay. I'll find you later.
He spins Bree out and lets go to slip smoothly into the crowd.
That was strange, says Mirabella.
I am going to tell the priestesses he is here, Bree whispers, but Mirabella stops her.
No, Bree. It was nothing. It is harmless.
Bree seems unsure, but eventually she nods and goes off to find another dancing partner.
I would know what happened to Arsinoe, Billy says. I want to know where Jules took her. I want to know.
So do I, says Mirabella,
and turns to glare again at Catarine. Jules catches the black-cloaked figure when they have stopped to watch the dancing from behind the folds of a curtained doorway. She grasps the figure from behind and covers their mouth, lifting them up so that, despite Jules' shorter size, the cloaked figure's legs kick uselessly in the air.
What do you think you're doing?
She asks, tearing down the hood and depositing Arsinoe in a corner.
Stop grabbing at me,
Arsinoe whispers, arms slapping at Jules's shoulders.
You'll get us both caught.
She pulls her hood back up to hide her face.
I only wanted to see. I told you to stay back and that I would watch out for her. Didn't you trust me?
And how did you slip away from Joseph?
Oh, like it was hard, Arsinoe says sarcastically. Ditching Camden was the real challenge. Where are they now?
Here, probably. Looking for me?
Jules purses her lips. She takes Arsinoe by the shoulder and begins to haul her out, down the quiet corridor, toward one of the servants' side exits to the street.
You are reckless, Jules says.
I know, but... Arsinoe struggles out of her grip.
Don't make me use my war gift to throw you out of here.
You would never, Arsinoe says and grins. But the smile slides off her face. Did you see the way they were dancing? Mirabella and Billy?
Jules puts an arm around her.
When she shoves her toward the door now, it is much more gently.
You say Mirabella loves you. Well, so does Billy.
They think you're dead, Arsinoe. They're probably missing you together.
But he'll be her king consort, won't he?
And if I stay dead, I won't be able to run away with him. Anywhere.
She looks down.
I was supposed to be able to let him know, Jules.
I know it's hard, but you can't be seen.
What good would it do?
We just have to get Mirabella through the duel, and then we can decide what to do next.
All right, Arsinoe says, and lets Jules lead her through the dark streets of the capital.
Catarine's eyes narrow as she watches Mirabella. Her pretty sister, so easily beloved by the island, so easily gifted. Everything for her so easy but never earned, never deserved. Beside her, Nicholas keeps feeding her bits of this and that and commenting on some of the stranger fashions. He is a fly buzzing in her ear. Catarine crushes a grape in her gloved hand, but the cloth is so thick to cover her poisoning scars that she cannot even feel the juice.
Make her look at me again, Catarine whispers.
Make her care.
But Mirabella does not. She goes on dancing with the Chatworth boy, as rigid as if she were strapped to a pole.
What did you say, Queen Catarine? Nicholas asks.
Nothing, she replies. The entire ballroom is focused on Mirabella. The Aarons have never seen so many turned backs.
Traitors, she whispers.
Catarine pushes her chair away from the table and stands. She is of so little consequence to the crowd that she could move across the floor unnoticed.
So she does.
Catarine appears out of nowhere and slips in between Mirabella and Billy like a snake, so fast that neither can think to act. Everything stops. Bows drag to a halt on musicians' strings.
Play, Catarine commands. She wraps her gloved hands around Mirabella's wrists and drags her to the middle of the emptying floor.
The music is an awkward plucking.
What are you doing? Mirabella asks, her eyes wide.
"Dancing with my sister," replies Katarine. "Though I would not call your movements dancing, exactly. Are your legs made of wood?"
Mirabella clenches her jaw. She grabs onto Katarine's gloved wrists.
"You are so afraid," Katarine smiles prettily. "The chosen queen would not be so afraid."
"I am not afraid. I am angry."
Katarine draws Mirabella in close as they spin slowly past the tables, past the gaping mouths of the guests, and servants frozen with trays raised in the air. After they pass the Westwood table, Lucas stands and walks quickly toward Natalia's chair.
"This is not done, Katarine."
"Then how are we doing it?" Katarine grins. She tilts her head to consider Mirabella's face and hair. "You are beautiful, sister. Hair so carefully brushed, cheeks so flawless and free of paint and powder. No scars and no rashes, even after all the presents I sent. Tell me, has even one found its way to you?"
"It found its way to a priestess."
Katarine clucks her tongue. "The poor girl. But that is your fault, for letting them intervene in our business."
She steps back and whirls Mirabella around.
Theirs is the only movement in the room, and the music plays clumsily, as even the violinists are staring.
"Do you know what I think?" Katarine asks. "I think you are a shame. I think you are a waste."
Her fingers trace Mirabella's veins, envying her unblemished skin.
"You are the strongest," she says. "You could be the one. But up close, you are such a disappointment. Your eyes are wary as a kicked dog's, when you and I both know you have never been kicked in your life.
Not like me, who has been kicked down with poisons and popped blisters and made to vomit until I weep.
That is why I am going to win," she goes on as they twirl.
"I may be the weakest, but I am a queen, through and through, all the way down to my dead blood and bones."
"Katarine, stop this now."
Mirabella's voice is pitiful, and she shudders when Katarine leans close.
"Do you know what they do with the dead queens, sister?" Katarine asks. "Do you know what they do with their bodies?"
She stops the farce of a dance to stand still in the center of the floor and jerks Mirabella toward her until they are chest to chest and eye to eye.
"They throw them into the breccia for the island to eat. And may I tell you a secret?"
Katarine's lips press to Mirabella's ear, almost like a kiss.
"They are tired of it."
The Breccia Domain. Peter walks his mare slowly through Innisfool Valley. She is tired. So is he. He traded his silver armband for her at the last coach stop before the mountain pass, and has not slept since getting out of the coach. Nearly 2 solid days of fast travel, by coach and on 3 horses. But he made it. Or at least he thinks so. He has only come to Innisfool for Beltane, and without the glut of black and white tents, the place looks completely unfamiliar. Peter rides along the edge of the southern trees. He is hesitant to plunge in. Despite sunlight so bright it is nearly blinding, the valley does not feel safe or peaceful. It feels watchful and over-eager for visitors. When they enter the trees, the mare shies and he dismounts. If she were to spook when they reach the breccia, she could send them both plummeting over the edge. He leads her slowly and pats her muzzle. She does not like these trees empty of birds, these woods empty of sound, any better than he does. Soon enough, the ground changes, and his mare's hooves ring off small, half-submerged stones. Peter lifts his head and sees the breccia, though he would swear it had not been visible a moment before.
the Breccia Domain, a deep, dark cut into the heart of the island.